Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast and have a great day.
I would now like to introduce our speaker for tonight, Bridget P. from Auburn, California.
My name's Bridget, alcoholic, and I'd like to thank Mike and the committee for the wonderful dinner and for hosting my husband and I, and my friends who are here for support. I just feel so blessed, and I just feel covered in God's grace, and that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for me. And if you're new here, stay, don't go. And if you're an old timer, stay and continue growing also. We need both. We need the newcomers and the old timers just as much. And I like to always say that my last name means in French by the vineyard. And so I married the right husband, and I found him in Alcoholics Anonymous too. Sobriety was a gift, and he was the door prize. We, at 2 years of sobriety, did our 13th step. And, you know, at first when I got here, I'm like, this meeting is incredible. I mean, the enthusiasm in here and the service work and the work that goes behind the scenes to have a group like this, it just doesn't happen. I mean, it really doesn't. These commitments are solid, and the enthusiasm is the breath of God. Now, that's what I've learned around here. And so always remember, you know, when the service positions are open, take them. You know, because meetings like this, I've heard of a lot of meetings that are so wonderful like this. Sometimes when people don't step up to the plate, something that was going so good can also, in Sacramento, we're in jeopardy right now with our meeting that was at the cathedral in Sacramento. So just keep on the firing line and keep up the good work with that. And my sobriety date is July 9th, 1994. And for me, that was the beginning of the end of the insanity. My drinking started at a very young age, and I don't blame that upon anybody anymore. Due to work in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. When you hear about my childhood, which I no longer blame it on, I just for me, it was a very difficult childhood. I was 2 years old, and my dad was 20. He took his own life. He was an alcoholic and a drug addict, and they, you know, my mom and him did that dance, and she was off gonna leave him, and he couldn't live without me and her, and so he took his own life. And my mom was 20 years old when this happened, and I was 2 years old. She did the best that she could do with her survival skills. A couple years later, she married a man in the Aryan Brotherhood, and that was pretty interesting. My brother's 2 years younger than I, and we grew up in Southern California. And a normal night at home on the weekend, on a Saturday or Friday or whatever, would be my brother and I being in the bedroom, jumping up and down on the bed, mom coming in, stuffing us underneath the bed, and my dad would jump on the bed and have a shootout with the cops in the apartments that we lived in. And a couple minutes later, the cops would come and smash the door down and ransack the house, and once again he was off to prison. And those prisons were in various places all over California. And he was in prisons where there was Charles Manson, where Timothy Leary was, and we would go visit him on weekends. And our family pictures consisted of Polaroids and convict clothes. And my mom had a boyfriend on the side, and we were told, you know, when we go to see Big Lynn in prison, don't tell him Mom has a boyfriend. And this new boyfriend would buy me toys. And I learned how to manipulate really good. I kept my mouth shut. And I'd get all these toys and all of this stuff. And pretty soon, Mom ended up marrying this guy. And he owned a furniture store. And I would go to school and tell the kids at school that he worked for Mattel, and I'd bring my dolls to school and give them away. I know now I would give them away because they had this big hole in my soul. You know, that's just like a cannon blew through it. I would do anything to make you like me. I sold my soul. And I continued to do that into adulthood. And so by the time I was in the sixth grade with my brother, some cops came to the school, some detectives, and we were escorted off campus because Big Lynn was getting out of prison. And this was down in Southern California in Torrance. And so we go home, and then we ended up moving here to San Jose under surveillance because we had no idea when Big Lynn got out what was going to happen to us, because when in our family people would end up missing, you know, people would end up leaving the state. It was always crazy stuff. We came out here to San Jose for about 4 months, and we laid really low, and I kind of wondered how come we never went to that Winchester mansion and all that, but we were being really low profile because we never knew if he was following us. And after a while, there was no news from him. So what we did was left San Jose and went back to Southern California so my mom could go find him. And she got back together with him. And I mean, this was on and on. This was normal in my childhood. So by the time I was 13 and found booze, I needed a drink. I did. Really, really bad. And that hole in my soul started filling up. I was friends with the bullies and trying to get their approval. Pretty soon when she stuck booze in me, I became the bully. I became the ringleader. And I always loved to hang around the boys because I could tell them what to do and lead them around. And I just drank and drank and drank, and I was very well protected. My drinking was so insane right from the get-go. And I remember when I picked up the booze, the next day I would think, oh my God, I feel so horrible. I never want to feel like this again. And the next day it was bam, it was on again. I would forget. And then I would wonder how come when I was drinking, how come these other friends would stop and I just needed more. I never had enough. It was like a human garbage disposal. I had blackouts. I thought blackouts were normal. I thought passing out was normal. I was in high school at about this time, and my life was just a wreck, a train wreck. My reputation was ruined. I would walk, you know, go to parties, and in our house we had this thing where my mom at this time, she would go on Wednesday nights and collect coupons down in L.A. on Wednesday nights, and we would go all night because she was strung out on whites and collect all these coupons, and we'd bring them home and then go get more, bring them home, and she'd keep us up all night. She was on the whites, but we weren't. And I was exhausted. And the next day school would be in session and the blinds were pulled and we wouldn't go to school. And we really had the potential of saving a lot of money from the coupons, but the truth was we never used them. And on and on and on. And we had this rule at our house that once you started partying at our house, you couldn't leave. And we had a lot of friends. Someone clapped, huh? So that was down in L.A., and I did my first geographic. My mom got together, back together with my dad, Dad 3, moved up to Sacramento, And I just drank down there and took myself with me, and I was jumping out of cars and all kinds of dangerous, you know, dangerous stuff when I drank, just to get attention, anything to get attention. I ended up moving up here to Sacramento, and my mom and dad told me that if I moved up here, you know, I could go to college, get a clean hand in life, and start all over again. And that sounds good to me. Plus, they offered that I could work and keep all of the money from the paychecks and buy clothes with them, so I was sold. And I registered for Sierra College and took all of these different classes. I wanted to be a psychiatric nurse. And that was my dream in my whole life. And I forgot I had, when I was down in Southern California, I had been in an accident. My foot almost got amputated. I need to tie that in. And so years later, as my drinking progressed and I was partying and I started drinking a lot, and a boyfriend from up here, from down there, moved up to Northern California, and one night he confronted me on my drinking. He said, "Bridget, you know, you drink just a little too much." So I chased him around the parking lot with a butcher knife. And the tail lights went off in the distance, and I never saw him again. And in my head, what came up was, you know, the guy really had no future going for him. You know, that's exactly what I had. And I went right back in the house and drank and just partied away. And the truth was, you know, people started confronting me about this stuff. And one by one, people, places, and things were disposable at a very, very young age. So I ended up meeting some party friends up in Auburn. And when you're in the hills like that, it's not too hard to find all kinds of things. And I thought I ended up getting caught up with the wrong crowd. And I thought, how did a nice girl like me get in a jam like this? And what that jam was, one night my brother and I were at a friend's house, and we had ran across some people that I had met a couple months before that. And we were out in the canyon partying, and these guys had an abundance of party goods with them. And when first he offered a lot, and then as the night went on, it started getting smaller and smaller, like toothpicks. And I thought, this guy's like holding out on me. So I got up all the courage I could and asked for a front. And he said, "I promise, I swear, I'll pay you back." And what I did was, I didn't know I met my future drug dealer. And went to go pay him back the next day, and the business that was a front was non-existent. So months and months went by, and my brother and I ended up meeting some friends that ended up knowing this guy. And one night we're at this house party and drinking away, and this guy comes home, and I go in the bathroom, and he said, "You know, your sister's really cute. I'd like to go out with her." And my brother whispered this to me, you know, and I thought, I'd never go out with a guy like him. He's a loser. He's a coke dealer. And I never left. I moved right in. And immediately, within a week. And the reason why I tell this story is, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I truly love it. It is the heart and soul of my recovery. It's where my alcoholism took me at a very young age. And within 1 week, I knew of way too much that went on in that house. And I was told if I left, what was going to happen to me. And beyond a shadow of a doubt, I believed it, because I grew up in a house like that. And I knew that people would end up missing and all this stuff. It was a very violent house. I grew up in it. I knew the deal. And so I recreated my childhood in adulthood. And my dad would come by and say, "You know, Bridget, you're a mess. You need to wear some more makeup. You know, you're not looking that good." And, you know, I'm drinking all night. I'm drinking and I'm doing this other stuff. And pretty soon my foot starts hurting me. And I'm all, "Oh, my God, what if 3 years ago they didn't get all the infection off my foot and I'm dying? Maybe, you know, maybe it's in my system now." And I started going to my doctors, and he suggested that I get a hobby. And I go to the next doctor visit, I get crutches because the pain is excruciating and I'm believing it. And then I go to UC Davis and for this appointment and told them all about my foot, and this doctor gets this clipboard, and on the clipboard was a release form. It said, on my next visit, they wanted the release for a videotaped interview on me. And I walk out of there and I think, what does this have to do with my foot? And I go in the waiting area, and my lower seeking companion, I thought at the time, which I attracted, of course, he said, yeah, they want to do a videotaped interview on you because you're a frickin' nut. And I never went back again. And on it with that abusive alcoholic relationship. And I was 21 at the time, and I ended up getting pregnant. And in the big book, it talks about it. The alcoholic cannot differentiate the truth from the false. And I was there. I was full flight from reality. And at 7.5 months pregnant, with my stomach sticking out to like there, there was a free pregnancy testing place in Auburn. And I'm all for free things anyway. And I'm like, I wonder if I'm pregnant. So I get up all the courage to go there, and I'm wearing bigger clothes, and I'm wearing my boyfriend's clothes and my brother's clothes and my brother's T-shirts and their, you know, underwear. And I'm hiding this pregnancy because I knew that if people knew that I was pregnant, they're going to hold out on me. You know, but the truth was I needed the alcohol. I needed what was there. I needed it so bad. So I go in I drive up and I pull up in front of it, and I'm like, okay, please God, I hope I'm not pregnant. And I go in there and I tell them the situation, that I would like a pregnancy test. And the lady's like, you know, she saw how fragile I was. And she's all, okay, sit down in this room. And she came back with this little baby and stuck it in my hand. It was a plastic one. And the pregnancy test came back positive. And she said, you have, you're pregnant. And I was like, oh my gosh. You know, and this plastic doll was in my hand, and it's developed. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I couldn't believe it. And I like to say that I was the last one to know I was an alcoholic. You know, everyone around me knew, and there was some lady who used to come over all the time, and she was my boyfriend's friend, and she said, Bridget, I'd like to talk to you. I would like to take you to San Francisco. They do third trimester abortions there, and I'll take you. And I thought, how dare her? I was just indignant. But the truth was, and I didn't know it, that God's grace was already in my life then. Because every time I was drinking, I was getting sick also. But I needed the booze so bad that I couldn't hold him down, but I couldn't, you know, I couldn't live without him. But I was haunted by this. I was haunted. And I had my beautiful daughter. She was born, and I would have nightmares, you know, if she has five fingers on each hand, five toes on each foot, and I would just wake up sweating all the time, and she was born healthy. I just, no matter where that alcoholism took me, I just could not do that. I just couldn't. And so it was just on and on, and I ended up working in a hair salon, and there was a woman who worked there, and I'll never forget her. She was my Eskimo. And we knew not to book her at 12 o'clock in the afternoon, because she went to Alcoholics Anonymous. And if she ever got a 12-step call, she would be dismissed. And I mean, we had that knockout, drag-out alcoholic thing, you know. I would call him names, punch him. He would choke me. I'd see gray. But I'd tell everyone what he did to me, but not of me provoking it. I was a perpetrator, is what I was. I've learned that in here through work in the steps. And every time she would mix color, I would go in the back room. And I'd say, Rebecca, you know, he says that if I got out of his life, that I'm a waste of life, I'm a waste of air. Do you think he loves me? And she didn't have the answers, and I think, damn, she's the alcoholic, she should know. He's an alcoholic. You know? And I would never look at my own drinking, and my drinking was horrible. So she said finally after a while, Bridget, you carry around a big bag of rocks and you need to go to Al-Anon. And that's all I needed to hear, because I could hear that because he was still a problem then. And by God's grace, I made it into Al-Anon and didn't make any major decisions for, 6 months and all that stuff. But when I did leave him, I took myself with me, and the bar drinking was on. In that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, I could not live underneath my skin anymore. I couldn't die anymore. I couldn't drink it away. I couldn't drink it away anymore. And what I'd like to do is, my bottom consisted of, from April 3rd to July 9th, when I hit my bottom, I was with, once again, some lower-seeking companions. We don't end up in those situations without, I take a look at myself now. And they inherited $10,000 because my best friend's boyfriend's mom died. And I wanted to stay so close to them because we drank and partied that money away. And from April 3rd to July 9th. In my bottom, at 29 years old, I was dying. And I was living at home with my mom and dad, and so was my daughter. We left her dad. And I couldn't make it from Grass Valley to Auburn, which is only like 12 miles. It was way too much. It was way, way too much. I couldn't handle it. But I knew if Noelle was with my mom and dad, she'd get a warm bed, she'd get food, she'd get to go to school. And I was a good mom. I volunteered in her classes on Monday in kindergarten, so she saw me on Mondays in her class. And she would come up to me and hug my leg and say, Mommy, Mommy, I'm so, she was so happy to see me, and I'd play it off like I was just the world's best mom. And my mom came over to that apartment and had this look of disgust in her eyes. And my brother invited me to his house, and I thought we were going to drink. And he had other news for me. My mom was going to get custody of my daughter. And I was devastated, but it didn't quit me from drinking. And I was cutting hair one day and in a shopping center, and Rayleigh's was further in the distance, and I used to love firemen a lot. And off in the distance, I saw this fireman guy, and I said, I'll be back in a minute, and went stalking him. And I had a really short dress on, and I really didn't respect myself much, and you got to do whatever you can to drink, right? And I went chasing after him, and he was going to his mom's birthday party in Tahoe, and he asked if I wanted to go, and I said, absolutely. And he picked me up after work, and we went across the street to Sam's Hofbräu, and I had a few too many drinks, and we're on our way up to Tahoe. He pulls over because I have to go to the bathroom really bad, and there's a bed and breakfast place with this wild wedding going on, and the bride's in the fountain, the groom's in the fountain, pants are up in the trees, and there's a little problem. I don't want to leave. And I make friends with the bride, and drinking all their stuff and eating their food. We decide to leave, and I get in his truck and sat on his glasses and broke them. And we did not have any money for a hotel room. And now I know I wasn't the kind of girl that you'd bring home to mom anyway. So he had some camping stuff, and we go camping. And he had tarps, and he laid it all out and all this stuff. And the next morning I came to on the off-ramp of a freeway, laying between tarps, and he's next to me. And I'm in love. I was in love. We go back home, and we exchange phone numbers. And I remember what fire department he worked for, and I called him since he didn't call me. And they're saying he's not available. And there was a problem, though. A couple weeks later, one of my best friend's husbands worked at this department and found out what happened. And she confronted me on it. And I was humiliated. And I got into Alcoholics Anonymous by God's grace. I just couldn't die inside anymore. And I got the strongest sponsor I could find and just started working the steps and was kind of scared. You know, people would hand the phone list around for the women, and I had phone list, and then they'd come up and ask me for my phone number, and I gave them fake phone numbers. And I started thinking, you know, sobriety was good, because later on in sobriety, I ended up getting engaged to a sheriff. And I thought, well, prior to sobriety, I'm with a coke dealer, and in sobriety, I'm with a sheriff. This is good. You know, but I found out, you know, that cops arrest drunks all day. So he didn't even know I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so I wasn't in a relationship. I conjured this all up in my mind. I found this out from working the steps. I brought a false self to the table. And so anyway, after that breakup, and that was like at 3 years of sobriety, I was devastated. And I found out really in sobriety for the first time ever what it was like, one day at a time, I have no choice, I'm not in control. You know, I was truly devastated. And at that point, my alcoholism when I found this out was, he's got a gun in the headboard, do yourself in. You've got nothing to lose. And thank goodness I called my sponsor. And she said, get to a meeting. And the meeting was 83 miles away. And I got there. That's what home groups are so vital. And I got to go in there and share what was going on. And so I healed through that. I found out what I brought to the table. I did the inventory. And I truly love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love being able to do the work with the steps and have God show me what no longer serves me. And that's all it is. It's like, here I am, all messed up. And God just kind of gently, lovingly guides me through the steps. And says, you know, shows me my character defects were my survival skills. And through the 12 steps, I just get to see what no longer serves me. And then I could get closer to Him and be the woman that God truly intended for me to be. And today, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am that woman who God truly intended for me to be. But I still need a lot of work to do. And I realize that and stay on the firing line with that. So I ended up meeting my husband, Doug, and I was so messed up. And for you moms in here, if you have anything where it's, you know, hard to learn how to get sober and be a mom, let the people in AA show you. You know, just work the steps. Just stay. And my daughter, to be honest with you, did not want to be with me. She didn't want to be with me. She would have rather been with her dad anytime. And I got to learn how to be a mom in Alcoholics Anonymous and learn how to take her for ice cream. And my sponsor suggested that. And I'll never forget when I picked her up from school. And I said, Noelle, we're going to get ice cream. And she looked at me and said, I don't want to get ice cream with you, Mom. And I was like, oh, my gosh. I called my sponsor and she said, yeah, she's probably wondering what's wrong with you. You've never done that before. And it was true. She'd get birthday presents, Christmas presents. On the weekend, she'd go to her dad's and pack them up in her bags. They'd say, Noelle, what are you doing with this? She'd say, I'm bringing it to dad's. And I was crushed. Her room consisted of a lamp, a bed, and it was stripped. So I got to learn how to start taking her to campouts and say, it's fine. If you go to your dad's this weekend, have him pick you up from the campout. And pretty soon she started to like you guys and see that you were family. And Doug came into our lives and helped tremendously with that. And he's her stepdad and has helped raise her for half of her life now. And that's all from working the steps. And I just can't believe, you know, what alcoholism, how it destroys and how this program mends. This program mends. And at about 3 years in Doug's and my marriage, we were doing service work, doing all this, you know, stuff, staying on the fire line, sponsoring and all this stuff. And he ended up getting Lyme's disease. And we didn't know it wasn't diagnosed for quite a while. And we were devastated, and I said, God, how could you do this, you know, to me when we're into service work, we're doing this. And sobriety is, we get to learn life on life's terms and how to walk through it. And I had a sponsor, and as far as it went was I would call her up when things were going on because Doug was literally dying from this. And I worked the steps so many times when he was first diagnosed with it. Not as anything to pat myself on the back for myself, just for my own sanity. You know, because it was killing me, and I was scared to death to pick up a drink. And I was sponsoring women, and all I wanted to do was pull up the covers over my head and push you guys away. But I remember hearing someone say, once you start shaving off H&I, once you start shaving off secretarying, once you start shaving off sponsoring, pretty soon AA is less and less, and then I grow a distance between you and me, and then pretty soon, for me to get comfortable underneath my own skin, my only option is to pick up that drink. And, I got to learn in this program how, the obsession centers in the mind. The obsession is, this is going to work for me. You know, once I would pick up that drink, I would have that phenomenon of craving, and who knows where it would take me. I just heard a lady say at the Women's International Convention in Oregon, she said, it's not that we pick up that drink and instantly, like, die a couple days later. It's actually, alcoholism is a slow death. We have no idea how long it would take for us to die, but we die immediately when we pick up that drink. And so I just kept on sponsoring and doing all this stuff, and our home group held us up. And when he was diagnosed with it, I walked in the bathroom and I thought, where do we go from here? And on the wall was the prayer of St. Francis in the doctor's office. And I called up my sponsor and I told her what was in the office. And she said, Bridget, God's in control of this whole thing. There's a bigger picture here. And I started to get into the St. Francis prayer. And in the language of the heart, when you look it up in the back, the St. Francis prayer is tied in with emotional sobriety. And it was just, I needed to dig in deeper and deeper just so I would stay sober. And you guys carried us through those dark times. And I did not have to drink. I don't believe that life on life's terms makes us drink. I believe that if I'm not in alignment with my higher power, that's when I'm going to drink. And so we went on with this for quite a few years, 3 years, and I thought, you know, I have all my stuff together. I'm keeping hold of the family. I'm working and getting, you know, putting food on the table and doing all this stuff. And during that time, we had the honor and blessing when Doug couldn't function much to get elected the Northern California Tape Librarians for NCCAA. And that's my family, you know. They're my family. They've become my family. And that was a blessing because there really wasn't much Doug could do, and it gave him a lot of purpose. We still live with the residuals of Lyme's disease. He's a lot better, but we're very grateful for what we have. So to fast forward, as soon as that was done, the following month, after he got in remission, the following month I was diagnosed with late-stage melanoma. And that was, for me, my life was turned upside down once again. And I just dug in. And I found out that a day would have made a difference. And I didn't know if I was going to live or die for about a month. And I'll tell you what, when that happens, there's no choice but to dig in with the program. And once again, you know, My sponsor's Polly Pete, and she's a long-distance sponsor, but she's only a phone call away, and I'm very current with her, and I just love that woman to pieces because my most important relationship that I have is first and foremost with my higher power, then with my sponsor, then with my husband and the rest of my family, in that order. And I made it through it, and I go into the every 4 months for checkups. In fact, not this Monday, but the following Monday, I go back again. And so I get to constantly realize what happened after I was diagnosed. I I called my sponsor and I was terrified, and luckily I didn't know it that God had it designed that I said, I don't know what to do. We're going down to SoCal for their H&I convention, and I have to be normal. You know, I have to act normal. And she said, you know what, Bridget, I'm down here right now. She says, we're going to do an inventory on this. And I truly believe that you will overcome this. And I believed because she believed. And when I got down there, we did some step work around it and got down to the roots and causes and conditions. I was very angry. And for me, the cancer represented for me a deep-rooted resentment. And I had to honestly take a look at myself. I had people to blame for that resentment, but when it was all done, resentment was at me. I was so mad at myself for allowing, for bringing something false to the relationships and allowing this to come into my life. And so there's a guy, Rick B. from Minnesota, and he said, Bridget, he said, I hope you share that story from the podium because it's very important. In the big book, it says, with resentments, it's to drink or die. For me, I didn't pick up a drink, but I was dying because of the other stuff. And so for me, I'm truly free from that now, and I'm more true to myself, and I do not operate under those circumstances anymore, because when I do, I know it's my character defects. And so that I'm really grateful. I'd like to, service work is still very important, sponsorship and all of that stuff. And my daughter now is 21 years old on Tuesday. And it's truly amazing. A couple years ago in our town, she nominated me for Mom of the Year. And my friends know this here, so I got to tell this story one more time. Anyway, what it said in this book was the reason why I was nominated Mom of the Year. It just said out of, you know, the adversity and all this stuff, you know, what I had done and all this wonderful stuff and being a business owner in the community and what I do and how involved I was at our church. And I'm reading this letter to Polly and saying, when I'm reading this to you, I feel like throwing up. But the truth was, I really liked what it said. And I said, I feel like throwing up. I cannot go to this dinner and be honored for this. And she said, Bridget, this isn't about you. This is God's grace. This is the woman that God had you be because of work in the 12 steps. And so I continued reading the letter on, and I'm thinking after we hung up, you know, I knew we had to go to the dinner and it was a formal event. And I look and I'm like, they don't even know I sponsor. they don't even know I do H&I. They don't know how many meetings I go to. On and on. And I'm like, oh my goodness. I mean, we could go from, you know, so excited about it to grandiose. So we did go, and it was truly a wonderful evening. And this young lady that Noelle is just truly amazing. And she did it again this year. And so this year it got to do something in our community again. And she got to escort me and walk me on the stage. And there was an interview the night before, and I had the questions, and one of the first questions was, what's the biggest accomplishment of your life? And I knew before that they knew all that community stuff. And I asked Noelle if it was okay if I spoke my truth and told them the biggest accomplishment of my life was getting sober at 29. Because when I was 29, I wrote a letter for when I died that I wanted my brother and his wife to get custody of her because they had such a nice home. And I said, do you mind if I put this on there? And she said, no, Mom. She said, that's okay. She said, actually, she said, that's your problem, not mine. That I'd go to AA. And so that was pretty funny. And then we get to so I went that night and got first runner up. And it was truly beautiful. And one of the next questions was, on a scale of 1 to 10, how do you rate yourself as a mother and why? And I said, a 10. And they said, why? And I said, because my daughter tells me so. And it doesn't get any better than that. And that's from you guys. You know, that's not me. And even bigger than that was, she got engaged last August. And she asked me if it was okay if she gets married on Doug's and my 10-year anniversary this year on June 7th. Because she wants what we have. You know. And because of the traditions in our house, you know, we don't have someone slamming their fist on the table saying, because I said so, that's why. You know, we have some guidelines here to live and bring in our own household. And I just feel so blessed from that. And I mean, it's just, it goes on and on. And I can't just say it. I mean, enough of, if you're new here, even if you feel like going, just stay. You know, get a sponsor. Get a big book. Work the program in the book. You know, and I'd like to share on sponsorship too, because it's just my experience with it. My sponsor tells me that as a sponsor, what our job is to do is to take a newcomer through the steps and have them have a dependence upon God and not us. And that's what the 12 steps are about. And it's not about dictatorship. It's about the program. And that's what I love so much about it too. If it's not in the book, we shouldn't be doing it. You know, however, if your sponsor does suggest it, they know better sometimes than other people do, because if they're your sponsor, they should know you pretty good. And you should be an open book with them, like I am with my sponsor. And you know, there's not one thing that's going on in my life today that I'm not clear that my sponsor doesn't know what's going on. And we work the steps around that kind of stuff all the time. So what in closing, I would just like to say thank you for the committee for asking me to be here, and just always remember that it's not life on life's terms that makes us drink. It's a lack of a spiritual alignment with our higher power that makes us drink.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.